Accession number 3997, Reel 1.
Do you have any previous family connections with the British Army, sir?
Yes, I do indeed, because I was the third generation of my family in my regiment. And on my mother's side, there were also several generations who served in the British Army. My great-grandfather became governor of Prince Edward Isle and also the Isle of Man. And my uncle became the quartermaster general of the British Army. And it was through him that I eventually found myself in the Sudan Defence Force. My uncle on my mother's side became an ADC to His Majesty, the late King, and his eldest son became the defense minister to the Sultan of Oman more recently. So I think I can say that we are fairly well represented. Two of my brothers also held regular commissions.
And you always wished to join the army yourself, therefore?
I had no other idea than that I wanted to join the army, yes.
So after school at Wellington, you went to Sandhurst?
That's correct, yes.
And which regiment did you join subsequently?
From Sandhurst, I was commissioned into the Royal Berkshire Regiment, and I was posted to the depot at Reading. From there, I joined the 2nd Battalion, who by then had arrived at Aldershot. And so for some 10 or 12 years of my life, I lived in that small part of England, a little bit of Berkshire and a little bit of Hampshire.
And what caused you to at least think of joining the Sudan Defence Force?
After I'd been serving for 5 years, and at that time the British Army was very below establishment, training became quite farcical. One had to represent soldiers by flags on exercises and further flags for machine guns. I decided I wanted a more active military life, and through the good offices of my distinguished uncle, I was able to get to the Sudan Defence Force.
What had you heard about the Sudan Defence Force before you arrived?
My uncle had been on Kitchener's staff when he went from Cairo to Khartoum. In fact, he kept a daily diary throughout that campaign. And some few years ago, I presented this diary to the Army Museum. He always said that it was a splendid place to serve, and the Sudanese were the most delightful people. I found subsequently this was absolutely true.
Had you heard any comparisons between the SDF and, say, the KAR or the RWAFF?
One soon learnt on arrival in the Sudan that the conditions of service and the general organisation of the Sudan Defence Force was very different to what one had supposed the other colonial forces were, because the Sudan came under the Foreign Office and the Colonial Office had no part or say in what went on.
What difference do you think that made?
That made a great difference, because the Colonial Office tried to rule not only the colonies but also the defence forces from Whitehall, whereas the Foreign Office allowed the local governor to get on with the job and the commanding officer to do his job in the way most suitable for the local conditions. And this made the Sudan Defense Force a much more reasonable type of unit to work in. The other big difference was that the Sudan Defense Force, having been formed from the Sudanese battalions, which had Egyptian officers, had already an establishment of native officers, whereas I believe the other colonial units relied entirely on British officers and British NCOs in many cases.
What was your first impression of Sudan when you arrived?
In those days, one arrived by sea at Port Sudan, and one was immediately hit by the hottest blast of hot air that anybody has ever imagined. However, once one got onto the comfortable train, which did have fan cooling, life became bearable again. And I think the first thing one noticed was the leisurely pace of life, and not only of life, but of the train also.
What sort of a greeting did you receive from your brother officers?
On arrival, one was made very much at home by the staff at the headquarters, and particularly by the Qaid, who was the commander-in-chief, who invited all new officers to dinner at his own house. And so one got to know him from the word go on a personal basis.
What sort of preparations had you already made?
Before one left London, one was given a long list of uniform and equipment which was recommended. And there was a famous shop somewhere near the Haymarket who used to supply all the officers with all the various topis and khaki uniform and that sort of thing. It was all, so to speak, privately purchased. None of it was British Army issue. One was advised to take saddles and bridles for horses and shotgun and tennis rackets and that sort of equipment as well.
Did you ever find that the list was incomplete in any way? Did you have to buy anything extra?
I think the only thing one had to buy when one got there was one's household furniture and pots and pans, because on arrival a British officer was allocated a bungalow, and he acquired his own servants, and he set up a bachelor establishment, which as time grew on became really a very comfortable home.
There was no mess as such?
Practically, I think there was only one unit where they lived in a mess, and that was the Sudan Horse. The cavalry unit. They had their individual bungalows, but they also ran a mess.
Does this strike you as rather strange, or was it all part of a very new environment?
Well, it was really very pleasant, because one was able to lead much more of a social life, and naturally one got to know the civilian representatives at the place, at the station, and life became very social.
Well, what sort of other civilians were there at the time?
Of course, life in Khartoum itself was rather more sociable than in the outstations, because that being the centre of government. There were comparatively few units in Khartoum, apart from the headquarters, and most of us went to one of the different corps on arrival. I was posted to the Camel Corps, where there would be a governor, a deputy governor, a district commissioner, a police officer, a veterinary officer, a medical officer, a water engineer. Those were the principal British personnel of the station, apart from the Sudan Defence Force.
What about people in commerce? Did you meet socially with those sort of people?
Well, there were very few British commercial representatives outside Khartoum. They would pay visits. In fact, at certain times of the year, particularly in the cooler parts of the year, the social life was increased by large numbers of visitors, mostly officials from Khartoum, touring the different areas and provinces. But the commercial life in the outstations was basically run by Greeks and Armenians, those type of people.
Did you see much of them?
Not exactly socially. One made use of their shops as retailers.
What about in Khartoum itself? Did you have the equivalent of the fishing fleet?
Oh, yes. The winter season was obviously a very popular occasion for many beautiful young ladies to come and spend a month or so in Khartoum, and life became very gay.
Did you see many missionaries in your time there?
There weren't many missionaries in the northern Sudan. I didn't serve in the south at all, and nearly all the missionaries were in the southern Sudan, where the pagan Sudanese lived. The northern was practically entirely Mohammedan, and therefore there were very few missionaries in that part of the country.
And what about mixing socially with the Sudanese in Khartoum itself, perhaps, or when you were out trekking? Did this occur?
One did not mix, in as much as one seldom visited their homes, mm-hmm. unless one was on safari, and then one would visit a village and one would go and see the head man, and he would invite one to drink coffee at his home. And it was considered a very bad thing if one didn't accept his hospitality. The Sudanese are the most hospitable people you could wish to meet anywhere.
Perhaps I could turn to conditions of service for British officers. Do you remember your pay, for instance?
Yes. One of the chief advantages of this advanced defence force was, of course, that one's pay was far in excess of that of an equivalent rank in the British Army. To begin with, the lowest rank of a British officer was Bimbashi, which is the equivalent of a major. And as most of us were young captains on arrival, so we immediately jumped the rank straight away, which improved one's salary enormously.
How did you save when you were out there? Did you use a local bank?
One had an account with the Standard Bank of South Africa, which was the main bank in the country, and one's pay was automatically credited to one's account.
And you found it easy to save, I presume?
It was very easy to save because weekends as such didn't exist. The ordinary holiday of the week was the Friday in the Muslim part of the Sudan. And it was only on rare occasions which one rarely went anywhere. There was nowhere to go for weekends. One used to organize shooting and fishing expeditions. Practically one's only expense was one's food and drink.
Yes. Did you keep horses for polo?
Oh yes, that was another expense, but polo was incredibly cheap because we all played on country bred ponies. And you could buy a perfectly good pony for £15 and train it yourself and have a jolly good game of polo.
Were there particular seasons for polo, or did this go on around the year?
Polo went on pretty well all the year, just occasionally in the rainy season one had to pack up because the ground was a bit too muddy.
And what about tours of duty? Do you remember how these were arranged?
As far as I remember, one's initial tour was for 3 years, and then it could be renewed for further periods of 3 years. But that rather fell by the wayside when the war came, and arrangements were static. In fact, one was not allowed to leave the Sudan. All the officers had to stay.
What was the normal pattern of leave in peacetime?
In peacetime, it was a rule that one had to get out of the country for 1 month in the year, which sounds a very large amount of leave compared to what one was normally accustomed to at home. But when one remembers that one really had no weekends and one worked pretty well solid for 9 months, one was very glad to have a month's leave, and in addition to that, one was granted 7 days from travelling between Khartoum and Cairo.
And were you obliged to spend the leave out of the country?
One had to get out of the Sudan, yes, because of the climate.
Mm-hmm. Where did you spend your leave, mostly?
Well, I used to come home to England, but I used to visit various places en route. One year I visited my own British regiment, who were then stationed on the canal. And another year they were in Palestine, and I visited them there. At least it was known as Palestine in those days, which gave me a very good opportunity to see the present Israel. Another year I went over to visit a brother in Canada. One had great opportunities to get around during this month's leave.
You didn't travel around the Sudan whenever you had any free time, other than this month?
No, one did enough travelling on duty, actually. Particularly once I became a member of a motorised unit, we used to go all over the country, in the north. But again, I never went to the south.
Just a brief note on food. What sort of food did you eat?
As a rule, one ate the normal food which one eats at home. Probably the meat wasn't quite so good. The sheep were a bit tough, but you got plenty of meat and vegetables. Fish was rather more difficult unless you were stationed somewhere near the Nile. But even so, one used to be able to buy kippers at the local Greek shop, which had come up by train. And one used to do a certain amount of shooting, partridge and duck, and the odd gazelle and guinea fowl, that sort of thing.
And your meals were prepared by your servants?
One had one's own cook.
Yes.
Who had his own boy to help him do the washing up.
Did you find that they were efficient? and trustworthy?
The Sudanese cooks are really world-renowned, and all the best cooks in Egypt were Sudanese. Mm. And many of them were taught how to cook in European fashion by the British people themselves. And the civilian officials had their wives, certainly in the winter. And, of course, they were very good at teaching them how to cook. And, of course, exactly the same thing has happened in Kenya. And all the you find splendid cooks in Kenya are mostly been taught by the wives of the British years ago.
Could we turn now to the structure of the Sudan Defence Force itself as it was during this time?
Yes, the Sudan Defence Force consisted of headquarters staff, the commandant, an assistant commandant, an adjutant general, and a deputy adjutant quartermaster general, assistant military secretary, GSOs 1, 2 and 3, director of supplies and transport, and a director of pay and records. The country was divided into four areas, each having its own corps. The central area, in which was located the Camel Corps, the eastern area, the Eastern Arab Corps, the Western Area, the Western Arab Corps, and the Southern Area, the Equatorial Corps. There were certain units in Khartoum, such as the Northern Training Depot, which was a young boys' training school, really. Then there was the Sudan Horse, with the cavalry unit, the engineer troops, the mechanical transport, and the Sudan Defense Force band, and an animal transport depot. All the corps and units had their own distinguishing badges, which consisted of a flash and a hackle. The headquarters staff wore a black flash with a white hackle. The Northern Training Depot had cross rifles on green with a black flash. The Sudan, the engineer troops had a brass grenade on a red and blue diamond shaped flash. Camel Corps had a black ostrich plume, but the officers wore the crest of the Crown Crane. The Eastern Arab Corps wore a silver shotal, which was a local type of knife or dagger. It was on a grass-green flash. The Western Arab Corps had a grey ostrich plume on a purple flash, and a machine gun company wore crossed machine guns. The Equatorial Corps had a red and green flash with a hackle with a brass numeral denoting the number of the company. The band of the Sudan Defense Force had a brass lyre on a crimson flash with a white and crimson hackle. Those were the distinguishing. The ranks in the Sudan Defense Force were based on those of the Egyptian army, and the commandant, who was known as the Farik in Arabic, equivalent of Major General, wore a crown with a crossed sword and a baton. The assistant commandant, who was Arabic title was Lua, wore a star with a cross sword and baton, and a colonel the Egyptian, the Arabic title being Mirilai, who was the a corps commander, wore a crown and three stars. The deputy corps commander, who was a lieutenant colonel, known in Arabic as a Kaimakam, he wore a crown and two stars. And the most junior British officer rank was a Bimbashi, the equivalent of a major, who wore a crown and one star. These badges of rank became rather confusing to the British Army, particularly when many British Army units came to the Sudan during the war. The native officers had their own ranks. There was the most senior native officer was the equivalent of what we call adjutant major, and he wore one crown. And the captain, who was a Yuzbashi, wore three stars, a lieutenant two stars, and a second lieutenant one star. And the other ranks, badges, followed pretty closely those of the British Army, with chevrons worn on the arms.
How exactly was this confusing during the war?
The confusion arose because of the Bimbashi being the youngest or the most junior British officer wearing a crown and star, which is the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel in the British Army.
So you were highly respected.
One was very
highly
respected.
By those who didn't know. And what was the general purpose of the Sudan Defence Force in peacetime when you arrived?
When the Sudan Defence Force was formed in 1924, after there had been a mutiny, the country was still in a state of unrest in many areas. And the first task of the Sudan Defence Force was to establish peace amongst the various tribes in the different areas. And so there were a number of minor expeditions and actions to bring this about. But by the time I arrived, all was quiet. All the renegades had been brought to heel, and therefore the main role was to show the flag